Are you here? Must be. I hear you breathe. Oh, I see you waving from the back row. Hello, fans of the spoken word. This is the Paul Leslie Hour, and welcome to episode number 1001. And we've got New Orleans blues great Johnny Sansone joining us today. Johnny's great. Check out his latest record, Into Your Blues. Oh, and you want to check out the Johnny Sansone Band in the Blues Tent on Saturday, May 4th at this year's New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. Check it out, NOJAZZFEST, NOJazzFest.com. And you know what else you can do? Why don't you like us and subscribe to us? It's the Paul Leslie Hour on Facebook and YouTube. Oh, that helps us so much. Are you ready for Johnny? I think so. Yeah, you are. I am. We are. Let's roll.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to be joined by Johnny Sansone, sometimes called Jumpin' Johnny. He is a blues man, a harmonica player, an accordion player, singer, songwriter, recording artist, entertainer. Johnny, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great, sitting here in the Blue Room in New Orleans, Louisiana, the Mega Blue Room.
What part of New Orleans are you in?
I'm in Mid-City, like by the Bayou St. John.
All right.
Yes.
Well, Johnny, it's good of you to join us.
Well, thanks for asking. Nice to be here.
It's a pleasure. I've been listening to you for a long time. And, you know, I remember hearing I was getting into blues music and harmonica music. And a man told me, he said, "Have you ever heard of Johnny Sansone?" And I said, "I don't know if I've heard of him." And he said, "If based on the stuff that you're listening to, you got to check him out." And I did. I've been enjoying your music for years, but I want to get a little bit of background on you. Where are you from originally?
Well, I was born in Orange, New Jersey. And I grew up in West Orange, New Jersey, till I got out of high school in 1975. And that's when I left New Jersey. I mean, as soon as I got a driver's license, it was time to go.
Yeah.
Hit the road, yeah.
Well, tell us about the stuff that you were enjoying early on. What were some of your early musical loves?
Well, I liked the same kind of music everybody liked. It, you know, when I was a kid, there was pop music, and where I grew up, we had a summer swim club, and a bunch of musicians were from our town. I can remember when there was guys that used to show up in the Cadillac limousines and sharkskin suits. And I remember saying, "Well, I wonder who these guys are coming to pick up their kids." And they were like members of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. And, you know, right around where I lived, there was so much music. Even now, when I think back, when I went to the YMCA to swim when I was a kid, and Sissy Houston's church was right down the street in Orange, New Jersey. We had La Cool and the Gang. There was a whole bunch of people a whole bunch of different artists that came from that era, between the late 50s and right up until the 1980s. So you know, I was influenced by a lot of early pop music, but I was able to get a hold of like some 45s and Jimmy Reed. And I had a fascination with the harmonica when I was like 12 years old. And I started to try to figure out why I liked this music, why I was drawn to it. And at the time, my father had me playing saxophone. My father was a saxophone player, and he got me started playing when I was 8 years old. So it really wasn't long after that that I wanted to try other things and was listening to a lot of different music that was coming. The more that I found, the more I was interested. And I don't want to keep rambling, but my father played, one of the big things that happened to me was my father played saxophone with Dave Brubeck during the World War II in Dave Brubeck's band and called the Wolf Pack. Google it. It's a really cool story. And I went to see the Two Generations of Brubeck concert with my dad when I was a teenager. I was probably 12 or 13 years old. And the Two Generations were Dave Brubeck's son's band. And a bunch of guys came walking out with long hair and stuff and started playing, a violin player, a clarinet player, and then a harmonica player came out. And I was listening to him, and I was like, wow, that's the stuff I've been trying to figure out. And I met the guy. We went backstage. It was the first time I'd ever been backstage somewhere. And I saw what it was all about. It was just in a skating arena, and it was just completely full. It was a life-changing event for me. And then I met this guy, and it was Madcap Maruth. I'm not sure if you know him, but he wrote down all of this information for me. Different people listened to different microphones to try to get. I was probably, I don't know, 12 or 13. So I went right to the store and bought, you know, it was Little Walter, Sonny Boy Williamson, all the Muddy Waters records, and I just went nuts. I was overwhelmed with it, and then I started playing guitar. And by the time I was 15, I was really, really submerged in this kind of music.
Don't try to push me when I don't want to move. It's gonna take time to get back in the groove. That will make me happy, baby. I do the same for you.
So you would say that there was something you were mentioning earlier. You're trying to figure it out. What was it about the blues? And I've always been interested in people's answers to this. What is it about the blues? What makes it so appealing?
Well, personally, it was speaking to me, and it made me feel like it was speaking directly to me. It was something about the swing and the attitude of it, the beauty of the sparseness, things that I recall that I just didn't understand why I liked it, but it spoke to me. It just seemed like such a brave statement. I remember playing over and over. I had ended up getting eight track tapes of Jimmy Reed's greatest hits, listening to this stuff over and over. And I just did not understand why it was so simple. Why did I like it so much? And I just couldn't figure it out. My friends were listening to Johnny Winter and a lot of the Allman Brothers, the things that were influenced by the same people that I was listening to. And I love that music too. But I felt like it was something that was mine, and I loved it. And I bought every chance I could get, I went and got more of it. And the more I found, the more there was. And I just keep digging deeper and deeper. And And I realized that a lot of this music was very regional to certain places. And then, you know, when I started realizing, well, wait a second, well, what is this? Now this sounds a little bit more country. And, you know, and I was finding, you know, Slim Harpo and a lot of the Gulf Coast music was something completely different. And then in Texas, you know, there was Lightning Hopkins, and that was a whole nother thing. And then there was T-Bone Walker, and it just never stopped. And I just bought everything I get my hands on. And I was just a kid. And now when I look back, I realize if anything that I lost out of all of this, it was when people play music from their childhood and say, oh, remember this? And I'm like, no, I didn't listen to anything like that. You know, I remember years later going to college and just like listening to, you know, nothing but Big Joe Turner for like a month. I don't want to hear anything else. I just wanted to understand Big Joe Turner, everything he did. And I was extremely committed to the music.
It kind of reminds me of a friend of mine not that long ago. He called me and he said, have you ever heard of a guy named Howlin' Wolf? And I said, yeah. And he's like, this guy called me up. He was just, you know, long story short, just losing his mind over what he's listening to. And I think it's kind of interesting that you have a Howlin' Wolf story. Do you have any memories of seeing the great Howlin' Wolf in concert?
You know, I've told this story a few times, and it seems to be like a dream to me now. Although I remember it exactly who I was and what I was doing. I remember the whole thing because it scared me. But it seems like a dream because it was so long ago. And it also was something that I didn't know what I was walking into. Yeah, I was a swimmer when I was a young kid, and I went to college on a swimming scholarship. But when I was a kid, I went to a swim camp in Miami, and I'm walking across the campus, I started hearing this music. Somebody's playing harmonica. It was on like a little pavilion, outdoor pavilion. So rather than showing up at the pool and everything, I walked over to check this out. And there was this enormous guy, and he's playing harmonica and he's singing and he's telling people to come to this show. And I had to push my way right up to the front. And I remember this because I was a pretty young kid, and these were all college kids there. And I just remember looking at this guy. I think, you know, this was one of the first times that I'd ever actually been in front of a real blues man. And I was terrified. It was like, he looked at me. I thought he was looking straight at me, and he looked like he was gonna, he looked threatening. He was so scary that I didn't, and he probably could sense that I was terrified. And then I noticed that he smiled a little bit to say, hey, kid. In my mind, he was saying, and this was a long time ago, but in my mind, I kind of remember him like smiling, like, don't worry, kid, this is just an act. And I said to myself, man, I walked away from that saying, oh man, what I just saw, I was already listening to all the music. So for me to get that was extraordinary. And then the first guy that I ever really got to play with was maybe a year later. 2 years later, something like that. And I went to a folk festival. And the first blues man I ever played with was Honey Boy Edwards. And it was at a, it was kind of a, like a harmonica workshop. And I got to play with Honey Boy, and I never forgot that. And then I saw him just before he died. He was playing in New Orleans at the Crescent City Blues Barbecue Festival. And I really wanted to go up to him and tell him that what it meant to me to play with him back then. And I looked him in the eyes, and I realized that he kind of wasn't home. So I shook his hand and patted him on the back. I don't think he would remember anyway. But that was a long time ago.
Would you say, Johnny, is being a musician, is it hard? Would you say that it's something that there's lots of people, they don't see the other side. They see the stuff that's on stage. They see the things that are a little more exciting, but they don't necessarily see the whole picture.
Well, interesting question. You know, I don't know what to compare it with. I've had a lot of hard jobs in my life, and I never really cared to get good at them, I guess, because I didn't really have the passion that I have for this. And you can speak to a lot of different people. A lot of musicians will tell you a lot of different things. There are guys that just say, you know, no matter what kind of bullshit you have to go through, it's worth it because you get to do something that you love. And you get pushed around a lot. Music business is not a fun place to be. It's especially when you're talking about being in a position where you're pigeonholed into something like the blues has come a long way since I started playing. The whole music business has changed so much in the last 15 years. This is a whole long episode of a discussion. I guess in a nutshell, to tell you, I'm very proud of the work that I've done, and I've worked very hard at it. And I'm still working at it, and I'm not giving up. I'm 66 years old, and I've been doing this my whole life. And I've made a lot of I made a lot of inroads to a lot of things I would have never got to do as the Wolf song goes, you know. Say, I met kings and queens, and I've done things even kings and queens will never do. Kings and queens didn't even know what it was that they were messing. But it's an interesting life. There's a lot of sacrifices involved. But again, you know, in any job that somebody has, I'm sure is tough too. If you're expecting to make a living and survive, it's a real difficult proposition. You know, a lot of people have to have other jobs.
Right, right. Well, kind of in keeping with that line of thinking, if you could, in some kind of hypothetical universe, if you could go back and talk to the younger Johnny when you were first getting started in the music business and give him any piece of advice, where you put your hands on your shoulders and say, listen to me, what would you say?
I didn't really have the guidance I wish that I had. My father died when I was pretty young. And my mother used to tell me, well, you need to get a manager. And I would think, well, what do I need a manager for? There's nothing to manage. I didn't really understand. I said, you know, until I got some options of some things that I'm trying to decide whether I should take them or not, that's when you need a manager. And I don't have those things. Yeah, I didn't realize that I would protect myself as much as I did to be so careful about proceeding forward in this music. There's a lot of things that had happened in my career that I look back and I realize now was a mistake. One of the biggest ones was when I finally got signed to a record deal. You know, I had to give up my publishing. I was writing these songs and I was I had to give up the masters and half the publishing. And I thought, well, why should I have to do that? I made these records myself. I wrote the songs. Why should I do that? I can make my own records. I can own all of my publishing. So I did that. And I gave up the record deal and I did that for years. Well, I didn't know what was going to happen later. I thought publishing would mean something. It doesn't mean much now because of the way music is now. There's no money in publishing anymore. And there's really no money in owning a master. Maybe there will be 100 years from now when nobody's making this music anymore. And it's turned into something other than actual music of the heart and emotion. It'll be made by machines.
Yeah.
Maybe then those masters will mean something. But right now, I was protecting something that I didn't know wasn't going to have any value later on in my career. Where if I had let the record label push me and help me, I probably would have moved a lot quicker forward. And I'd have talked to several people. This is very personal for me to talk about, but they told, you know, I had heard from people that I was unmanageable because I wanted to do things the way I wanted to do them. And looking back, I would tell that kid, let people help you, not everybody out to get you.
Interesting stuff. I appreciate you sharing that. Now, I'm hoping you can tell us about some of the great, great harmonica players that you've had a chance to either share a bill with or meet through the years. Name some of the all-time greats that you've met personally.
Well, starting at the beginning, my first year of college, I think I was about 17 years old, and I got to meet and be friends with both Junior Wells and James Cotton. Now, back then, they had Alligator Records was sending. I was going to college in Colorado, Colorado State University. And back then, Rounder Records was, Alligator Records was sending their acts out on these tours, and they were hitting college towns. And, you know, I had records of these guys, so I had to go see them. So I was the kid that was there for the sound check, and I was there, you know, I wanted to meet them. And I come to find out that they were both willing to help me and interested in the fact that I was interested in them. You know, this was in the 70s. And, right up to the time that both of them had passed, I got to be close friends, and we cut through the years all the times that I'd been able to talk to them, and they watched my progression and what I was doing, and it was an exciting time. Now I studied with both of those guys and learned a lot early on, and to anybody listening to this, watching this review, you would say, well, there's so many people now to learn from. There's all kinds of YouTube and all this, you know, clubs and places you can go. And back then, we didn't have any of that stuff. There wasn't a whole bunch of harmonica players. There was a couple of guys. You'd have to really go to a city to find guys that were any good. And understanding technique from the masters, the people that invented this sound, the Chicago Electric Sound, they were right there, and they were helping me personally. I'll never forget how important that was to me. And then, I guess the next one was, there was so many, but the really important was I went to see George Harmonica Smith when he came to Denver. And at the time, he had a young William Clark with him. And William Clark is just a year older than I am, or maybe 2 years older. I had some records, but I really didn't know about the West Coast sound that much. I didn't know how they did play chromatic and stuff. William Clark was one of the guys that just stopped everything to pick up a chromatic harmonica and show me things that I didn't know. And things that were not being done by guys like that I learned from. And he had learned from George Harmonica Smith. So that was a really enlightening time. And then I got to see George passed away shortly after that, but I got to see William Clark several times after that, talk to him and hang out a little bit before he died. All the greats. I mean, there's so many, I don't even know where to,
Yeah.
People that I really respect. I can go back a little bit further than this, which is another great example. You'll find this interesting, but I had bought these Jimmy Buffett records because I love the harmonica playing on them. I really like anything that had harmonica on it back then I was buying when I was in high school. And I really like songwriting. So I was buying records by Texas songwriters and different people. And I found Jimmy Buffett, and I love this harmonica player. Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, I love the harmonica player in that band. So I bought the records. And I remember going to the Bottom Line in New York City to see Jimmy Buffett. And I was going to try to meet the harmonica player. It was Greg Fingers Taylor. Now, Greg had an incredible style that I was so moved by. I could tell that he wasn't a alternative country kind of guy. I don't know where it came from, but I didn't really know him that. I didn't know him yet. But I had pushed my way, I think it was like 17 years old, and I pushed my way through to get to the front. Then I watched the show, and then I pushed my way to get to the backstage area, and Fingers was standing there, and I introduced myself, and he said, oh man, well, come on backstage and hang out for the late show. And I remember telling Fingers, I got to have my mom's station wagon back before midnight. I can't stay for the show. He didn't realize I was just a kid, So that's when I first met him. And then I was in Memphis. And I can't remember what year it was. My first record had just come out, probably 1985 or 86, something like that. And this girl comes up to me and she says, "Hey, do you know a guy, Greg Fingers Taylor?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I know him." And she says, "He loves your new record and he's sitting right over there." So he was watching our show. So I went over and I talked to him, and I told him that story about, how I came out. He gave me some advice, and we hung out for a little bit. And we were just, after that, we were complete friends for till he just passed away this few months ago. And I learned a lot from him just because he would tour with us and we would go out on the road together and I would open the show and play and then he would play with my band. So we worked a lot together and I realized where he had come from. I mean, he didn't come from country music. He got put in a situation where he sounded good playing that. So he created his own style. And I still love that style so much. And I can still play it. I'll give a little pointer out. There's a movie called Blaze that came out a few years ago. I don't get too far off the subject, but somebody might be interested in this. It's a story of Blaze Foley.
Yeah.
It was directed by Ethan Hawke. And somebody gave Ethan's my number and said, you need a harmonica player. This is your guy. So I did all the harmonica parts. I'm not the actual guy. The actor's an actor that plays the harmonica player, but I'm on the set playing through the whole soundtrack. So all the harmonica you hear on there is me. And I am just summoning up all of my great fingers, Taylor's kind of stuff. And when I went to see the movie, I mean, I never pat myself on the back about stuff, but I went to see the movie and I couldn't believe it was me. It just sounded that good. And of course they had really great people, engineers and everything. And it was all acoustic and it was just beautiful. So there's a soundtrack record too. So, you know, it's worth getting into. So, we did a lot of shows with, Sam Myers, and I came to find out that Sam was the guy that taught fingers how to play. So, you know, I had my guys and he had Sam. And that was really great to learn from Sam too. It was hard to get information from, but if he liked you, he would hand it over. And I mean, there's so many. I could go on, but you probably have other questions.
Well, I just want to tell everybody out there on the note of Greg Fingers Taylor. First of all, I remember doing an interview with him at one of his shows, and we took a little break. And he told me, he said, "Oh yeah, man, you got to get everything from Johnny," and he was referring to you. And he said, "You need to get all his stuff."
So, oh God.
I thought you should know that. But also, something is coming up. It's called Sing for Fing
at
3rd and Lindsay on October 5th. 3rd and Lindsay, the renowned music venue in Nashville, Tennessee. And it's an evening. You're going to be performing. A bunch of great artists going to be performing as a kind of memorial or tribute to Fingers Taylor. So, again, that's going to be October 5th. Some of you all might want to think about getting in the car and taking a little road trip for that. Now, on the note of Buffett, how did your song Popeyes and a Hubbigs, how did that song end up on that Margaritaville Cafe Late Night Gumbo compilation, which is a great CD? And I know Fingers, he was so proud of that, you know, being the, I guess, executive producer or whatever on that.
Well, Fingers produced that record. And I had just put out my self-produced record, Crescent City Moon, which I sold to Rounder when I signed the deal with Rounder. And I had an outtake. So there was a song called Popeyes and a Hubbigs. And a little inside information on that, I did a interview with Dan Aykroyd, and he was saying, what is a Hubbig? And it's pronounced Hubbig, but it's a little fried pie that you can buy here, you know, when you go up to checkout counters and stuff. It's a very famous thing from New Orleans. And Popeyes is a chicken. And when I was trying to get this really greasy sounding instrumental on the chromatic, and I told the guys in the band, just make believe you ate a 4-piece box of Popeyes and finished off a Hubig's pie after. And then you had to walk down the street in 100 degree heat in New Orleans. And the guys in the band were kind of like, oh, okay, I got it. So, because this is the way you would feel if you got that greasy. So the song came out very greasy, and I had an outtake. So we only did two takes of it. And we used one take for the record that I did. And then I had an outtake. So I was playing this I was driving around New Orleans, and I had Mark Hummel and Fingers were in the back seat of my car, and I was playing it for them. And they were digging it and saying, well, what, that doesn't sound like a Cro-Mat. What is it? You know? And I was like, well, it's just some greasy shit I came up with. So Fingers like, well, what are you going to do with it? And I said, well, I already put it out. It's on there. So I got an outtake. So he's like, oh, I got it. Okay. Let me hear the outtake. So I gave him the outtake and he put it on that record. He's like, man, I got to put this out. So that's how it ended up on that record. And now, I'm glad it did, because there are people that didn't have any idea what it was, got to hear it. It's good exposure. Thank you, Jimmy Buffett.
Yeah, absolutely. Jimmy Buffett was such a lover and proponent of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. We should also mention that if anyone is interested, and I would recommend that they check out, you're going to be doing a trio show at this year's 2024 New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. How many jazz fests have you done?
I'm not exactly sure. I know. I think the first one was in 90. I mean, you see, probably 1990 or 91. And I played the main stage back then was called the Ray-Ban stage. And I had produced a record for this guy, Walter Lightningbug Rhodes. And we got him on that stage. While I'm telling stories, I mean, if everybody's interested in a little backstories, I had my 1956 Fender basement amplifier with me. And back then they didn't have any of the reissue ones or anything. If you had one, you know, you were very fortunate. And I had it sitting on stage and I turned around and I was like, where is it? And I thought somebody maybe stole it or something. It disappeared. And then I turned around and pointed to the stage and I looked over and George Porter Jr., who, you know, George Porter from the Meters, the bass player from the Meters, he picked it up and he was carrying it and he said, where do you want me to put this? So he was like being the stage hand. And I couldn't even believe I was actually on the stage, on the main stage. And then George Porter Jr. is carrying my stuff for me. So it was like an amazing day for me. And I think, I know it's been at least 30 years that I played in a row under my own name, but I can't remember. A lot of those years I played a couple of different shows, or I sat in with other people or whatever. It's been at least 30 years, I can say.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to have this interview with you. I hope that we get a chance to speak again, perhaps even in person, face to face. But Johnny, I always like to give my guests the last word. And I've heard everything through the years from buy my record, go see me. What would you say to anybody who tunes in closing?
Well, I guess off the top of my head, I would say that there are so many people out there trying to survive doing what they love to do. And no matter what that is, you should try and support it. It's easy to go and support things that just because they're easy to do. It's difficult and out of the way to go find musicians and support them. But it is very important to keep the arts alive And we're going to be seeing a lot of problems with this. We already are. It's been impossible to be a recording musician now, because we used to sell CDs and we could pay for some of our expenses, our gas and hotels with that. There are no CD sales anymore. And I would say, if you see somebody has a CD, don't go and tell them, oh, I don't have a CD player. Just buy the CD. Take and give it to somebody that does have a CD player, because that money's going to help that guy to get down the road to the next thing. And believe me, every CD that he has is went hundreds of hours of his life to make that.
Yeah.
Because being in the studio, not only all the hours that you spend writing and producing music, all that funds is like buying a car or building a house. You know, you have these things when you're done. In the end, what do you have? You have this music, and it needs to be important to you, and to, you know, there has to be reasons to make it, and not just to make money from it, but to get it out. It's important to you that you make a product that will continue your love of the music and what you do. And it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of money. And in the end, we just hope that it means something. And the only way it can mean something is if somebody wants it. So hopefully you will have a collection and be proud of it by obtaining music made by the people that make the music, not somebody else.
It's a great way to support independent recording artists. I always like to ask people who live or spend a lot of time in Louisiana where they like to eat, because it can be a source of joy later on. So for anybody out there who's watching, where would you say they need to eat?
Well, that's a good question. At my house. I guess it depends on what you're looking for. Like seafood, one of my favorite places to go. And the fact that the guy has live music. It's an interesting situation. It's just a crab shack. Some of the best crawfish you'll ever have in your life. It's an open parking lot with just oyster shells, parking lot with a little stage. It's called Scythers. It's in Harahan, and Scythers Seafood. And that's my number one place to send somebody when they come to town. And the people there are just great. It's you'll be very moved, I promise you. For Creole food, there's dozens of different great places just in my neighborhood. Giacomo's is a great place. It's right next to the Maple Leaf. You can go to Giacomo's, have a great dinner, and go to the Maple Leaf and hear a great band. Of course, it's very famous for seafood. So, you know, there's a lot of places to get fresh raw oysters. I won't name them, but there's, make sure you get them.
I'll take that advice any day. Right. No, Johnny, there's something I really can't resist asking.
All right.
So tell us, do you have any story about fingers? There are stories that I can think of just being around him not that I was around him a whole bunch, but he was a guy that, you know, it was exciting to be around him. But do you have any tales about being around the late, great Greg Fingers Taylor?
Well, Greg's passed, and I think I could tell some stuff. But when I think about the ones I'm thinking of, it doesn't matter that he's passed. I still can't tell him.
I got you.
I wouldn't want them out there.
I understand.
One of the things I learned from Fingers, and I probably shouldn't tell this story too. I wouldn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Something I learned from Fingers, and he probably learned it from Jimmy Buffett, but Fingers had a beautiful way of showing his appreciation for people and their friendships. And he would make these cassette tapes, and he would send them to people. And I don't know where he got this music. He was an incredible musicologist. He would find, I don't know where he got this stuff, people I'd never heard of, and you probably could never find on your own. And he would make these tapes. And we realized how lucky we were by how many tapes we got. And he would send them to different people. And I can remember being out in California, and I was on a show with William Clark, the great William Clark. And we were talking about Fingers tapes. And Bill Clark says to me, we were talking, comparing different ones. And I think it was Onion Breath Baby. I said, "Do you have that one?" He's like, "What? Onion Breath Baby? I don't have that." He's like, "I got to get that." I said, "Well, you're going to have to call Fingers." And he's like, "Oh, man, you got to give me Fingers' number. I got to get that one." It was like so precious to have his collection. But when you were with Fingers at a show, people would come up to him and say, "Oh, Fingers, I saw you. I can hear the drums ringing behind me. I hope they're not coming out on the sound, but
not right not too there. Much."
Fingers would be saying, somebody would say, I saw you in Cincinnati, like, you know, 28 years ago or something, and the show was so good. And you were like, you were on fire." And Greg will be like, "Oh, yeah, I remember that show." And we'd be standing there going, "What's he doing?" He said, "I remember that show. I think I remember you, too. Yeah, I do remember you. You were there." And he would just make people feel like, you know, and we walk away and say, "Greg, you don't remember that show." And he goes, "No, I don't remember any of that stuff. But the guy thinks I did, and he feels better about himself." So I realized that, you know, it's okay. It's okay to do stuff like that. And he was so good at it. And and I realized, you know, that I didn't know the difference between being a musician and an entertainer till I got around guys like Fingers.
So Johnny, were you around Jimmy Buffett much?
No. Not really. We went to some of his shows because Greg would get us, you know, tickets. I remember I took my mom and my sister. My mom was a big fan, so she was very excited. And we got to go backstage and, you know, eat the giant shrimp and have the giant margaritas. And Fingers brought us out and showed us the stage set up, and she got to meet Jimmy. And that was a really big thing for her. And I just remember we were like third row in this big auditorium, and there was all these people behind us that I knew paid a lot of money for their seats. And we were sitting there. And I think this is the only time in my life that I saw my mom with a joint. Somebody was passing a joint, and she actually took it from the guy and tried to pass it past me and my sister to whoever was on the other side of us. And I said, "Mom, give me that." I threw it on the ground and I stepped on it. Because she just thought, you know, hey, I'm at a Jimmy Buffett concert and these guys, you know, somebody will want this thing. But I'm getting a little too far into this. I'm enjoying this this interview a little too much. So I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Johnny. And just one more thing that I'm just curious before we go. I know we're in overtime here, but can you tell me real quick, what is the inspiration behind your song, "The Lord is Waiting, the Devil is Too," which I hope everybody checks out.
Yeah, please do. I didn't want to talk about it for a long time because it was something that happened to me. I was coming home from a gig and I was going to pick up my girlfriend at a late night bar, and I pulled up and I had some of the guys in the band went back in the van, and somebody forgot to put the lock on the trailer, but all the equipment was in. So we pulled up and I got out and I saw the trailer door was open. So I leaned in to see what might've fell out while we were driving. And then I got a gun in my bag and I turned around and I realized what was happening. And I looked in this guy's eyes and he had a bandana and his head was covered with a hoodie thing. And I looked in his eyes and I could tell he was somewhere. I'd never look in the eyes like that. He was somewhere. He was possessed and it was very scary. And I wasn't sure if I was going to die or not. And I was able to get out of the whole thing. I said, he said, "Give me your wallet." And I said, "I don't have a wallet," which, you know, I did. But so I just came from a gig at the Maple Leaf and I had a giant roll of, you know, fives and tens and ones. It looked like a whole bunch of money. And I said, "Look, man, if you got to just stay cool, I got a whole bunch of money in my pocket. If you'll just stay cool, it's all yours." And I kind of talked my way out of it. And I got home and I realized that I almost died that night. And the next morning, I was still traumatized. And I was thinking, well, you know, every day you wake up, there's two decisions you can make. You know, something is waiting for you and it could be good or bad. And I just saw that. I got past the bad and I don't know what saved me, but whatever it was, I was still here. And that was what really made me think of. And when you hear the song, "That Guy Is in This Song," I didn't want to spill too much information on it because I really wanted everybody to use their own imagination when they listened to the song. But that's pretty much what led me down that path.
Interesting stuff. Well, Johnny Sansone, thank you so much. It's been such a joy, and you've been so generous with your time. I've been entertained. I've learned new things. I hope everybody who watches or listens feels the same. It's johnnysansone.com, SANSONE.com, and lots of great gigs, as I've been mentioning. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival on April 30th, then this Sing for Fing concert at 3rd and Lindsley in Nashville. Johnny, thank you again.
Yeah, I'm very proud to say, too, I have a new manager and a new agency, and they're worldwide, and they're great. So I think I'm finally going to become an ear town. Wherever you are, please come out and support if you can. We'd love to see you.
Oh, great. Thanks. Yeah, check out the calendar, folks. Yeah. Johnny is coming your way.
No matter where you are, we're coming for you. All right, thank you.
All right, thank you so much.
We thank you and appreciate you dropping in for the Paul Leslie Hour today. You know, you can help the Paul Leslie Hour in our mission to provide independent media content like this by visiting www.paullesliehour.com. thepaulleslie.com/support. We truly thank you. This is your announcer speaking. Performance of The Entertainer intro song and Corina Corina outro song, courtesy of John Premorano. Well, that's it for today. So until next time, be safe and be good.